Welcome to CenterPod Podcast. This is the AI voice narration of Swamps can protect against climate change if we only let them. It can be hell finding one's way across an extensive boggy moor, the partially dry, rough ground and the absence of any landmarks let the eye rove helplessly into the monotype distance. Everything undulates, the rise and fall share the same muted palette, and the sense is dull. But a swamp is different. In it, in addition to water, there are trees and shrubs, just as reeds and rushes are the hallmarks of a marsh. Although water and squelch are everywhere in a swamp, there are landmarks, down trees or jagged stumps, a tenanted heron nest, occasional islands of high ground hardwood stands, called hammocks in the south. Yet the swamp traveler goes not in a straight line but slouches from quaking island to thick tussock to slippery, half-submerged log. Even with GPS technology, big swamps are places to get lost, and in the past many people with a reason to melt out of sight, Native Americans threatened out of their territory, runaway slaves, Civil War Army deserters, moonshiners, and bloody-handed murderers, have hidden in them. For a few seconds, I once considered hiding in a swamp myself. When I was 10 years old, my family lived in a rented house in Rhode Island. Saturdays were free time, and I sometimes went to a nearby swamp. A fisherman's path circled the swamp. Far out in the water stood the unreachable hulk of a dead tree, branchless, tall, white, and with a large hole near the top. I had somewhere read that great blue herons nested in such snags, and that in one swamp a man had brought a ladder, placed it against a tree, and climbed up to look into a heron nest. The heron stabbed him in the eye as he came level with the nest, and the man, his eye and brain pierced, fell dead from the ladder. I wanted to see if there was a heron nest in this local swamp's dead tree, perhaps even a live heron, perhaps even the remains of a ladder, perhaps even a sun-bleached skull nearby. When I got to the swamp, I saw a small raft and a pole lying on the bank. There was no one around. I pushed the raft out into the tawny water, got on board, and began poling toward the snag. I was halfway there when I heard furious shouts and screams. Looking back, I saw the two worst boys at my school jumping up and down on the bank and hurling futile clods of mud. I had stolen their raft. After a quick look for a hiding place, I changed direction and took an oblique route to the farthest shore, where I pole vaulted onto firm land, found the path, and rushed away from the scene of the crime. It was some time before I noticed that I was still carrying the raft pole, and I leaned it helpfully against a tree before continuing home. Many modern Americans do not like swamps, herons or no herons, and experience discomfort, irritation, bewilderment, and frustration when coaxed or forced into one, except for a few, like my mother, for whom entering a swamp was like plunging into a complex world of rare novelties. My mother's hero was Henry David Thoreau, the enigmatic New England surveyor naturalist essayist. Thoreau has been called the patron saint of swamps, because in them he found the deepest kind of beauty and interest. He wrote of his fondness for swamps throughout his life, most feelingly in his essay, Walking. Yes, though you may think me perverse, if it were proposed to me to dwell in the neighborhood of the most beautiful garden that ever human art contrived, or else of a dismal swamp, I should certainly decide for the swamp. He went so far as to describe his dream house as one with windows fronting on a swamp where he could see the high blueberry, panicled Andromeda, lambkill, azalea, and rhodora, all standing in the quaking sphagnum. Many people vaguely understand that wetlands cleanse the earth. In fact, they are carbon sinks that absorb CO2, and they are unparalleled in filtering out human waste, material from rotten carcasses, chemicals, and other pollutants. They recharge underground aquifers and sustain regional water resources, buffering the excesses of drought and flood. In aggregate, the watery parts of the earth stabilize its climate. Wooded swamps are at the end stage of a fen-bog swamp succession, legacies of the Ice Age, when the melt started the sequence by first creating stupendously huge lakes. Lake Agassiz covered more than 100,000 square miles of Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, North Dakota, and Minnesota. Lake Missila covered about 3,000 square miles of what is now Montana, its repeatedly bursting ice dams and cataclysmic floods spread through Idaho and Washington and created bizarre giant ripples as the long-ago gushers scoured out the channeled scablands of eastern Washington. The melt turned much of the North American continent into wet ground, with long chains of swamps gouged by no-breaks glacier that plowed across the terrain. Burly new watercourses captured smaller streams and made deltas and estuaries. In the 19th century, the United States enlarged in a fever of land acquisition, the 1803 Louisiana Purchase, involving 800,000 square miles from the Gulf of Mexico to Canada, doubled the size of the country. In 1819, the Adams-Onis Treaty added Florida and part of Oregon. 525,000 square miles of Texas were annexed in 1845. The Oregon Treaty, in 1846, enrolled the Pacific Northwest from Northern California to the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Great oceans and lakes framed the country, and the interior roiled with tangles of rivers like unspooling silver ribbons. All that territory had once held a wealth of wetness. Scientists have estimated that approximately 221 million sopping acres existed in the early 17th century, much of it swamps, and 200 years later many swamplands remained. As the United States pushed its borders, its population leaped from 7.2 million people in 1810 to 12.8 million by 1830, almost doubling in 20 years. The welcoming arms of open immigration became the hallmark of America, and that reputation lingers in global memory. Despite today's more painfully stringent reality, the original occupants of the continent knew the rivers and swamps, the bogs and lakes, as they knew the terrain and one another. But for most English settlers and European newcomers, nature consisted of passive and inanimate substances and situations waiting to be used to human advantage. Preservation and care of nature were not what they had come for. The first generations of overseas settlers concentrated on claiming the easiest farmland near the shore and in the river valleys. To their mind, there were no local resources. Everything had to be imported or reinvented. As invaders, they had constant battle with indigenous people who defied them. It was not until the Revolutionary War ended and the Indian Wars devolved into treaty-making that the population noticeably increased and a need for more farmland brought settlers into the upland forests. The growing scarcity of good farmland revived old stories of swamp and marsh drainage. Farmers already knew that a wagonload of muck from a nearby swamp would enrich the soil, renewing yields that had weakened over the years. In addition, during the Civil War, moving heavy guns and personnel through swamps was incredibly difficult. Soldiers often resorted to laboriously clearing bypass routes. One of the men wrote of wading through knee-deep and deeper mud in North Carolina after the Battle of First Gum Swamp. The brambles were thick and thorny, the water coffee-colored, alive with creeping things, the air heavy with moisture and foul odors. These memories persisted. Across the country, the ongoing stories of vile adventures in the muck made it clear to military, government, and citizenry that something had to be done about the swamp so universally detested. Everywhere there were horrendous mixtures of fen, bog, swamp, river, pond, lake, and human frustration. This was a country of rich, absorbent wetlands that increasingly no one wanted. After a rainstorm, any curious child who drags a stick obliquely away from a rivulet sees the rivulet forsake its original channel and follow the stick's trail. The stick dragger has discovered the principle of drainage. It is this innate existential curiosity that has led humans to commit unthinking malfeasances against the natural world. Farmers grew up with shovel in hand ready to cut drainage ditches. The government was solidly on the side of drainage to increase land area, in part for incoming immigrants. In 1849, Congress passed the first of several swampland laws that turned federal wetlands over to the individual states with the right to dispense those water-sodden acreages for purposes of drainage. These laws perpetuated the myth of endless land free for the taking, and showed an inability or an unwillingness to observe changes in nature over the seasons and years. By the 1980s, roughly half of America's wetlands had been wiped out. Aerial photography made wetland size estimates possible, and in 1990 the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service published a study showing that since the 1600s the country's treasury of wetlands had shriveled to 103 million acres, and that some states had lost almost all their original wetlands. The single-minded desire for more agricultural land linked to automation and the transfer of field labor from human to machine, along with the growing customer base of non-farming populations for cheap foods and grains, has come with a terrible cost. Between 2004 and 2009, another 62,300 acres of wetlands disappeared to agricultural interests and housing developers. And more continue to disappear because of sediment deposition patterns, fertilizer runoff, spilled and leaking chemicals, increasing floods, storms, droughts, and fires, and today's rising sea level. Rising sea level is both subtle and blatant. We hardly notice it until a storm brings vast flooding. For example, at Naval Station Norfolk, in the Hampton Roads region, a natural roadstead channel of deep water in Chesapeake Bay, fed by the James, Nansemond, and Elizabeth Rivers, seawater is now swelling up at an unprecedented rate. The environmental writer Jeff Goodall visited the station and wrote, "There is no high ground on the base, nowhere to retreat to. It feels like